Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on December the 28th of 2016. It's been quite a year, and this is going to be the last one to wrap things up for us. How's it going, Chris?
Well, I'm not dead, which is not something that everybody can say this time of the year. 2016, people have noted it's been particularly harsh. Despite the fact people die every year, but everybody's really angry at 2016 for killing people. And it has been, you know, a lot of celebrities have died. And I do have to wonder, there's only a couple of days left of it. You know, now that Carrie Fisher's dead, all the hot celebrities are dead. Do they move? Does Death's Touch move directly on to the Z grade podcasters like us? Like, am I going to have to worry about, it's going to be like a Final Destination like scenario where Death's following me. Like, I can't get away from it. And I'm going to be, like, sleeping. And, like, it's going to be this crazy Rube Goldberg-like scenario where I'm asleep. And the chain reaction will start with, like, my dog Scotia in another room farting. And it'll somehow end with a bulldozer coming through my room and crushing me. You're just going to be like, shit, I guess it is coming for us, dude. It's right at it. It was Carrie Fisher, then fucking Chris. I'm like, oh, man. Bummer.
Yeah. Confirmation bias is a thing. With this string of celebrity deaths, it does happen all the time. I think people are just generally more aware of it now. But, you know, like, I think the first year that Twitter was popular was when we had the Summer of Death with it seemed to be mostly B-grade celebrities and then Michael Jackson, honestly.
Oh, okay.
Is it Billy Mays, David Carradine?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, I guess Carradine probably wouldn't be considered a huge name. But yeah, I've noted my not displeasure. I've just always noted the oddity of it on Twitter. But I can recognize people are upset. You know, a lot of people they like are dying.
Yeah,
but
you made that. I saw the tweet you wrote, which was like, 2016 has killed everything except just damn you 2016 jokes or something like that.
Yeah, and it's just that notion of like, I wonder what's going to happen when the first celebrity of 2017 dies. They're like, no! You were supposed to be different! For 4 days, nobody will die, and everyone will be like, thank God. Well, nobody famous will die. And everyone will be like, well, 2017, huge improvement. And then it's going to be like, oh, Stan Lee's fucking dead. Everyone's going to be like, why? You were supposed to be different, 2017. I believed in you.
The Grim Reaper comes out and is like, look, guys. Yeah. I'm not going to stop killing people.
Guys, people die. Like, not for nothing. Not many of these deaths this year have been that shocking. It's not like a lot of people were murdered. It's a lot of people died of old age or, let's be honest, some pretty hard lives.
Seriously. You know how many drugs a lot of the celebrities were on the tide this year?
Yeah.
It's like, Gene Hackman died. It's like, guys, he was like in his 80s. I mean, I love the guy, but
yeah, he
didn't go sooner or later.
Hadn't been movies for like 10, 20 years at that point. I mean, it's usually a sign.
But to get off of that subject, we are gonna go into a pretty lighthearted series, I think, that was recommended to us a couple of weeks ago. I believe under the pretense that I complain about every single harem romance comedy series, about how, the protagonist is this clumsy around women guy who is mistaken for a pervert all the time. His life is so terrible or something like that. And, this is, I think, our second webtoon that we've done. Second Korean webtoon.
Third, wasn't it? Between
the third. I know there's Tower of God, of course.
Was It's Not Your Fault I'm Not Popular considered one?
That's a Japanese webcomic.
Okay.
Second and a half, I don't know.
Well, then wasn't there also that, I don't know if it was I think it was. It was, God, I can't remember the exact, Onella Tarasu, or what? It was that magic series that we read a while back. It was at the end of a year. I can't remember the exact name of it, but that was another Korean series that I feel like might have been there. Regardless, we don't get many of these.
Not too many. I mean, we are a manga podcast. We do take manhwa suggestions occasionally. This one came across us, and essentially what it's about is it's a bit of a take on the, you know, clumsy, mistaken pervert trope, except the guy actually seems to suffer negative consequences from it. And it's explained in a very simple manner, honestly. But we'll get into it. Our story follows... God, this is going to be so terrible. We've gotten so used to being able to pronounce Japanese names, and then we get these... Occasionally we get one that's like, oh, I've decided to use, you know, Spanish names for my characters for no reason. And then, of course, every time there's a Korean series, it's like, God damn it!
I feel like I don't remember their names. I feel like the first one is Sungi, and the...
It is Sungi.
And the Playboy is Sunbae.
No, it's Sungi is our protagonist. Kyungnim is his tutor, so to speak. And Sina is the girl. What we start off with is Sungi is this clumsy guy who keeps on getting mistaken for a pervert by, you know, bumping into women's breasts, accidentally falling into them in his hands, and, you know, winding up in their crotch or whatever. And he's something of a social pariah because of this. He's taking cram school classes in order to get into a good university with a scholarship. And I actually like this detail. Either everyone in the class hates him or they're part of his fan club who just take pictures of him accidentally groping girls so that they can go and jerk off to them later. It's such a weird thing. It's like, no, well, you know what?
They're like, look, if it's going to
fall, everyone
can
just hate this guy. and eventually what happens at the start of the series is that there is this girl who, pretends not to be repulsed by him, but she just does it to take advantage of him. She leads him along by treating him nicely, acting like she's a little bit romantically interested in him, so that he'll empty out his wallet buying her nice little gifts or running errands for her. And she just treats him as a gopher. And I ain't saying she's a gold digger, but he's not the only guy that she does this to.
Yeah. Men exist to be wrapped around her little finger.
She's a man-eater. And eventually he encounters her at the same time that she's with one of her richer boyfriends. And... he gets coldly rejected because she essentially weighs the two of them up and is like, oh, this guy's got a nice car. He buys me nice designer bags. This guy will buy me a coffee occasionally before he goes broke. You're ugly and disgusting. I can never like a pervert like you, so get out of my face and never want to see you again. And he's rejected and he feels bad. And this entire time, he's been observed by one of his classmates, Kyungnim, who is this gross-looking guy. He wears, like, a track jacket and really uncomfortably short shorts. And he wears these big, square-lensed glasses. He's got this, you know, shitty little mustache. He looks gross, and he lives literally, like, on the roof of the school. Which, like Onizuka.
Yeah.
So, Kyungnim recognizes that Sungi needs his help, and he reveals himself to be this secret playboy with all these techniques that he's trained over the course of a few years to master the art of talking to and dating women. So he's going to teach him to be a playboy. Reading the first couple of chapters of this, I was very concerned that this was going to be about, if this was going to have a message of Sungi learning that women are all evil and that they are to be used and then discarded. Especially because one of the first times that we see Kyungnim when he's in his playboy guise is when he is letting a girl down and breaking up with her. So I was worried that this was going to be a deliberate harem series about this guy who has no skills with women, eventually just, you know, sleeping with a bunch of women and then discarding them. It's not like that at all, actually. Mm-hmm. And the longer that this series went on, there are definitely problems that I have with this manga, webtoon. But overall, I came away from it quite liking it. There are problems with it, I think because there are certain elements of it that kind of conflict with the main core of the series, which I like. And I don't think that it always presents it in the clearest manner. And there are some things that you could get from it where you could say, like, oh, yeah, you know, redpill.com or whatever, you know, women are, oh, can't trust them. You know, you gotta just manipulate them with colorful language and all these different techniques, and that's the way to deal with women always. Which is not the point, but you could easily take a few scenes from this manga out of context, and it could look that way.
One thing to kind of note about this series is that it's done in all in color. So it's kind of refreshing for us who, you know, we only generally read a black and white series to be like, oh, wow, this thing's in full color. Everyone's hair, I can tell what color it is. And most of them are normal.
See, nah, your hair would look like gray.
But I think what kind of works with Seonggi is this, you know, this is an archetype we see all the time. It's almost the joke of harem series. The protagonist is usually like a kind of meek kid who stumbles into situations where he bumps into brass or, you know, falls into a crotch or things like that. But with Seonggi, it's not like it's not that so much he gets the results from it. Like he gets punished almost every time for that sort of stuff. It's the fact that he legitimately doesn't mean to do it. And most of the time he's trying to avoid doing it. But because he's just so clueless, or because he's so clumsy, or because the universe is just, like, mathematically aligned to fuck with him as much as possible in some moments, it's constantly happening. Like, he's legitimately not trying to be a pervert. Like,
in fact, he is actively trying to avoid falling into situations where he could be mistaken as such.
Yeah, like, his sole goal is, like, I do want to meet a girl who I can fall in love with and who loves me back. Like, he does have an interest in women, but he's not trying to, like, sit down the train and be like, the girl across from me has her skirt open too wide and I can see her underwear. And usually when that happens, you know, everyone will notice, someone will be like, hey, you're looking at that girl's underwear, pervert. And I'll be like, no. Or sometimes he'll be like, well, I'll turn my attention away. That way I won't be seeing her underwear. And he'll turn his face. And again, the karmatic gods have fucking aligned it that he turns his face like right into like a breast convention, but like a feminist one where it's like, no men allowed. And he'll be like, no, I'm not trying to peek. Like
I think it's something like there's a sequence where he's on the train where, yeah, he like sees a girl's underwear. So he politely averts his gaze. Then he turns headlong into a set of boobs that are right next to his head. He stumbles away from them and like his hands end up down like a girl's pants. And he's like, let me explain myself. I can see that girl's panties.
Yeah, he can see a girl's underwear. Then he's like, I'll avert my gaze and sees that the girl's shirt's too low cut. And he's like, I'll just close my eyes. That way I don't see anything. So then he stands up into a pair of breasts. And he's like, oh no, I'm so sorry. Like, tries to motion away and, like, plants his hand firmly on the previous girl's chest. And he's like, wait, no. This only happened because I was trying not to see her underwear. So it's like all three of the women. I mean, that last one, I can't give karmatic justice. That's just him being dumb. I don't know why I needed to, like, rationalize that. But yeah, like, all the girls are like, you're a pervert. And he's like, I'm not. Like, it's not that, I guess it's a case where I don't feel like this is a character who's taking advantage of the fact that he's constantly put in these situations per se, because he legitimately seems like a good kid who doesn't really want this to happen. It just kind of keeps happening for him.
Hyung Nim eventually explains it fairly early on in the series. He rationalizes it by saying that Seonggi is kind of afraid of women. Not that he's like, you know, just scared of the opposite sex, but he is scared of being mistaken as a pervert. And so it's something that does happen, is he tenses up whenever he gets into a situation where, you know, there is an attractive woman nearby him. And he's just like, I hope I don't do something that makes me be mistaken for a pervert. And he tenses up and inevitably he just kind of falls into it. In reality, that wouldn't happen nearly as often as it does to him. But it was nice to have like that very simple, like, well, of course, yeah, he feels tense around women. He can't be himself around them, and he's not relaxed around them, which is why he's a dateless loser. And if he's terrified of them and he can't confidently, you know, explain himself, then yeah, of course, he'll just end up getting punched or slapped. Because we see occasionally, especially when Seonggi starts to regain his confidence, like, he does, like, you know, bump into a girl's, you know, his face into her tits. And he's just like, I'm sorry, you know, that was an accident. and, you know, just cuts through the tension much more easily.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah, well, like, I think what helps is that it's not a series that glamorizes his actions. That's not the way I'm trying to explain it, per se, though it doesn't. But it doesn't... Women don't find him cute or endearing because of it. Or it's not like he slams his face into their chest and is like, oh, God, I'm so sorry, and they call him a pervert. But then they're like, oh, I'll give you a leading phrase to let you show what your true character is. A lot of women just tend to judge him right off the bat when it happens, or he gains the confidence to get past that. But this isn't a situation where it's like, I'm the dorky kid and I keep running into these girls, but then afterwards we find out we both have to watch the pets together and you get to see my true side or anything. It's not like that. And I think what helps in this particular kind of series is that Sung-hee himself, because of the fact he doesn't want all this stuff to happen, it kind of makes him a little bit likable, at least in the sense that you're like, he's not like all this perverted stuff's happening and we get to see all the fan service, like that's ignored. But because of the fact he's actively trying to get away from it and trying to, you know, better himself, it makes him a bit more endearing than your prototypical harem lead who generally just stumbles into this stuff because the author's like, we need to put some tits and ass in this chapter.
And, I mean, this artist clearly does enjoy drawing the female shape. It is clearly like kind of a dual purpose action whenever, Sung-hee stumbles into a girl so that they end up in a certain pose. But I mean, yeah, it definitely makes him seem more endearing that there is this twist on the usual way of going about it. So essentially what happens in this series is that Hyung-nim takes pity on Sung-hee and he's like, I'm going to teach you the skill of lure. I'm going to teach you how to be a pickup artist so that you can talk to women. And it's interesting because Hyung-nim's got this incredibly positive way of looking at things. And it's not, you know, bullshitting stuff so that he can, you know, sleep with a bunch of women. The way that he sees it is, if you know how to talk to women in a certain context, then you have opportunities to have a good time. And you can actually seize on the opportunities that could eventually lead to you ending up with someone romantically. There are going to be, you know, things that happen where, you know, the chance will arise, and if you don't know how to take advantage of it, then you're going to lose it. So if you know how to talk to women, then you're going to eventually be able to do that. And, I mean, he doesn't really so much teach him how to be a pickup artist so much as he teaches him how to date. Mm-hmm. Which is perfectly fine.
Yeah.
I should point out, like, I'm not an expert on how dating works because I've had one girlfriend and she asked me out when we started dating. I'm not going to say it's like, oh yeah, this is, you know, part and parcel of it or anything, because it's like, I really don't know it as well as some people would. But he does stuff like, he just shoves Sung-hee out into the deep end. It's like, hey, just do this one thing. And then you can come back. And Sung-hee's like, I can't do it. He's like, just do it. He shoves him towards a girl, while they're in the subway. And he's like, just go talk to that girl. Just introduce yourself to her. Ask her what her name is. Give her a compliment. Something like that. And Sung-hee, you know, basically falls flat on his face or really timidly does stuff a bunch until he has a very mild success. And he, at one point, is made to, I think, ask for, like, a whole bunch of girls' phone numbers until he eventually gets one. And he eventually is complaining to Hyung-nim. He's like, why are you making me do this? I'm just failing over and over and over again. And Hyung-nim tells him, you're not failing. Failing is not taking the chance to talk to a girl ever. Failing is never giving yourself an opportunity.
As the great Wayne Gretzky said, Nick, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
And he gives him a bunch of encouragement, like, you know, you did not fail. she, you know, lost out on the chance to get to know you.
Yeah.
You, and to have a good time, you know, even if, you know, you don't end up marrying each other, you don't end up going on a date or anything like that. Hey, if, you know, you're able to talk to a girl, then that means that you have the chance to have a, you know, even so much as a pleasant conversation. And he demonstrates this a couple of times, like, I'm just going to go talk to this girl. And then we're going to, you know, joke around a bit and we're going to make each other smile. You know, there's value in all of that and in making other people feel better like that. And it's so refreshing to see a character who's like that, who takes that approach, which is not, it's not so much as, oh yeah, you know, every single girl that you talk to, or every single member of the sex that you're interested in that you talk to, you've got to see them as a potential romantic partner. Well, no. but you should be able to just talk to people.
Yeah.
Because, hey, I mean, God, that's why we're humanity, so.
But we're not computer programs?
I mean, we could be. Most people who listen to us have never seen Metis in person, so as far as they know, we could be very advanced AI.
Yeah. Yeah. I see, I've been watching Westworld a lot recently, so I'm of the mind, I'm like, am I an AI? Am I a host? I stare at things and I wait for myself to say, it doesn't look like anything to me. And I'm like, oh God!
What is that? You're just looking at nothing.
Yeah, I'm like going crazy. Yeah, I think, it's a relatively short series, actually, and not
it's about 35, 40 chapters long.
Yeah, and the chapters themselves are not particularly long, so
mm-hmm.
the content of which to discuss is a little bit more limited without going into a ton of specifics, but I did just...
Well, I should point out that, I mean, that's the premise of the series. It very quickly becomes more of a straightforward romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Focused on one relationship. I was honestly expecting that Sungi would, like, actually end up going on a few dates, like a few failed dates. Things narrow down to him and the female lead, Sina, and how their relationship progresses through the rest of it.
Yeah. And I actually think as, like, a comedy, it's not the most hysterical sort of series I've read, but this is one of the few series that were intending to make me laugh actually accomplished it more often than not. You know, it's not the same style of humor as like Keijo, where like butts are flying everywhere, but there is actual humor that comes about in mostly just how eccentric Sungi is, like by himself or when situations are forced upon him. Because it's weird, he's not like the most charismatic guy, but when he's alone, he's like, oh, I'm super cool, I can't wait for these things to happen! Like, he's super, like, you know, has a big personality, but I do find it kind of funny, the relationship between him and his Hitch, whatever his name is. I thought it was Zumbay for the longest time, but apparently it's not.
Hyungnim. Yeah, they, honestly, like, this series does relationships really well. We only see a couple of them. There's only a few, you know, so many important characters, but, Sina and Sungi have a really cute relationship that progresses, and the friendship between, Sungi and Hyungnim is honestly really nice. There is something that happens fairly late on in the series. I can't remember the exact context of it, but Hyungnim has given him this really big pep talk, which, and just says, like, you know, you're a pretty good-looking guy, you're nice, you're smart, you know, any girl would be lucky to have you. You know, you're a really good guy, and you should not forget that. It's not important to know all of the techniques for picking up women. What's, you know, important is just being who you are, and eventually someone is going to see that. And it's... It is honestly something that's like their relationship is so close and well developed. It's like, why aren't they just like gay for each other?
He's like,
I can totally see that because they really care for each other and get close to each other.
Yeah, he's like, any girl would be crazy to lose out on you. And then like he leaves the room. He's like I am.
Like I did. I can pick up any woman I want, but not the man I wanted.
Not the one I love.
Yeah, it's It's kind of a weird, like, there are some weaknesses to the series, partially in terms of how Hyungnim just, like, very carefully lays out the different techniques for conversing with someone, and how you can lead a conversation with forceful, subconsciously forceful, wordings of stuff. And kind of artificially create a connection to somebody. It's kind of an underhanded thing for some, for a guy that says, like, oh yeah, you know, you just want to, you know, get to know a girl and be able to have a conversation with them. He explains it as being like, you need to be able to talk with somebody in a way that you can control the pace so that you're comfortable with it. Mm. But it's still kind of weird. It's a little creepy at times, honestly. And there is an antagonist that is introduced in the series. His name escapes me at the moment. Who uses the skill of lure for evil purposes. Essentially the way that I expected the entire series to go. Just, you know, using it like, picking up women like a jerk. He literally, like, kind of just picks up women just to do it. He sets, like, a daily goal for himself to just collect phone numbers as he goes through life. It's weird.
So, in trying to find the names of these characters for this, I searched Skill of Lore, and mm-hmm. there's no, like, standard Wikipedia for it. There's, like, a Wikia for it, but I was looking for just a regular Wikia. But I found a link to Reddit, but it didn't show me the subreddit for it. It just mentioned Skill of Lore. It's like, okay. Oh, okay, let's see. Someone's talking about this. Let me see. I clicked on it. I was like, oh, we're on the red pill. And that's, yeah. There's an entire thing on that discussion. I was like, all right, let me just process all. All right, fair enough.
It's important to take the entire series in context because, yeah, individual parts of it is, can be very problematic, honestly. When you look at the main relationship in the series between Sina and Seung-gi, it is not based on Seung-gi manipulating her into having a relationship with him. And in fact, the antagonist, Boman, goes on a date with Sina. And it's, the chapter is kind of laid out almost like a dating sim. He's got like this mental bar of him advancing the relationship between the two of them. And by the end of it, he's like, yes, it has reached 100%. She will be madly in love with me now, because that is how this works. Women are like robots that you have to program into having sex with you.
They're games.
But what happens is, you know, the next day, Boman's like, oh, yeah, we should go on another date. And he's like, no, I think we should just stay friends. He's like, what are you talking about? Wasn't our date great? He's like, oh, yeah, it was wonderful. But honestly, I didn't, you know, feel like we actually connected. And he's like, what do you mean?
Well, I got 100%.
Yeah. She's like, you seemed too perfect. And this references back to this conversation that she had with Seung-gi right before she went on the date, where he was actually talking in reference to her, because she is this perfect seeming girl. She does like, modeling work on the side, and everyone idolizes her. She's smart and pretty and charismatic. And so she kind of is opening up a little bit to him, and she thinks like, oh yeah, you know, why does everyone think that I'm perfect? And he's like, well, you know, perfection, people aren't perfect. Someone can seem perfect to one person, but never to everyone. And if they seem perfect to everyone, then it's probably because they're putting it on. They're trying to appear perfect. Mm. And so she remembers that when it comes to Boman, who seems perfect to everyone on the surface, unless you know exactly what he's doing, which only Hyungnim and Seung-gi know. But because he seemed so artificially perfect to her, she rejected him. And this leads to him getting really pissed off, because this has never happened before. How could this have happened? And he gets really pissed off. He starts threatening to get like violent with her. And Seung-gi fucking punches him in the fucking face. It's one of the most satisfying punches I have seen in a manga or manhwa. And I have read over 1,000 chapters of Hajime no Ippo.
You're like, none of the punches in that series were worth it.
It's like, It's like the ripple from JoJo goes through his face. It's so great. Yeah, I mean, like, if you take the entire series in context, it's good, but it really does toe the line a few times with stuff like that. It's like, if the series did not have Hyungnim explaining this is, you know, what this is actually for, and this is what the purpose of it is, and it didn't have Bumon abusing it and then getting his comeuppance for it, then yeah, you could definitely take this to Red Pill and be like, oh, hey guys, here, yeah, there's this freaking how-to guide that lays out individual techniques step by step on how to get a girl to open her legs up, no problem. So yeah. Especially with how it begins, with the girl, you know, manipulating Seung-gi and him wanting to manipulate women back, like, really comes close if you don't read the whole thing.
Yeah, there definitely is the context, but I think what it all kind of ends up being worth it at times, just because the relationship that does eventually bloom has some real moments between them. You know, they actually do develop something and have a real connection there between them. So you don't just kind of have to deal with this idea that he's, like, if it were a series of dates where he's constantly trying to pick up women, you might find yourself, like, almost getting into a pattern. But the fact that they eventually get into a relationship and have to start kind of responding to things or dealing with the conflicts between them, that helps it as well kind of grow beyond that initial premise. It has a simple premise from the start. Guy who has no luck with girls getting advice on how to pick them up. I mean, it's the movie Hitch, but in Japan and with kids. But
essentially, yeah.
It has a better kind of, not conclusion, but it continues on in a way that slowly starts to build upon itself and make it something different. You know, all those elements are still there. Seung-gi is still always kind of getting advice and help from, Hyun-bae, is it?
I think that's his first name.
Hyun-bae.
Hwang-jae Hyung-nim.
Hyung-nim. He's still getting help from him. Like, there's a point where he goes to, his girlfriend's house, whose name I also can't remember. They go to her house, and he gets like a text from him in the morning that's like, hey, I left before you, good luck. And it's just like, he's just being a wingman at that point. He's just there to try to help this, like, look, man, I'm trying to help you out, progress your relationship forward.
There's a bit late on where they've essentially started dating, but Seung-gi is like, I don't know, she seems kind of like distant from me now. Like, I don't know what's going on. What should I do? Tell me what to do. And he's like, dude, just let her, handle this at her own pace. Like, I can't tell you how to do everything. What are you going to do? You know, come to me when you're thinking about having kids and ask me what to do.
Yeah.
Hey, but he does handle it in some, handles it in some funny ways, as well. Like, there's a bit where the three of them are studying together and he just leaves and he's like, I need to go to the bathroom. He's like, oh, I'll come with. And, you know, so he's like, I'll come with you. I'm going to the bathroom. Stay here. I mean, it's honestly like, it's heartwarming at points too. Uh-huh. I really like the art in this series.
Yeah.
There are some bits where it is very comedic. But honestly, there are some times where they're just having a quiet moment together. There's a two-page spread towards the end of the series where Sina kisses Seung-gi on the cheek for the first time. She just, like, doesn't expect it while they're sitting together. And it's this very warm picture of them sitting together, both blushing while she does it. I really like a big part of the series. And if it weren't for those bits that I said, you know, this is problematic if you take it out of context, or even in context, it's sometimes a little creepy, I think that I would freaking love this manga. As it is, I do really like it.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I definitely agree with you on the art, too. I do love the way they managed to turn him from being a dorky-looking, as you mentioned it, like how almost like frumpy-looking guy, but just a shift in the art style really does make you think, like, oh, wow, this guy actually does make sense as, like, a Casanova kind of guy. Like, I could see that in him.
I love how they explain it, because, like, you know, Seung-gi, like, observes, when he sees Hwang-jae for the first time in his lady killer guys. He's just like, well, I mean, he shaved and he took his glasses off and he combed his hair differently. He's still not the best looking guy, but yeah.
It's a very solid series. I think, again, you should be aware of some of that stuff going into it, but I really don't think it's like, it's not as problematic as some you might worry it is based on us kind of bringing it up a couple times. It's something worth considering as you're reading through it. And again, you do have to take the entire series in context while you read it, but don't worry about there coming in a situation where you're just like, holy shit, man, this is fucking Trump's America manga right here. Like, yeah, it's ultimately a series I think you're going to have fun reading, that you could enjoy the art in, and it's a quick read. You know, that's a pretty nice thing about it too. You get a complete story with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quick read. I mean, I've read it in like 2 days, I think, honestly.
Yeah.
So, good stuff.
There we go. Boosh.
All right. With that done, we are going to head into our recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap. And we're going to start with My Hero Academia. Oh, pardon me. First of all, we had the results of the popularity poll come in. I like a bunch of the notes at the beginning of it before they give the top 10 stuff. There are a number of characters where we see how their place changed, whether they rose or lowered. Also notes about how Pikachu and Mega Man somehow got votes.
I like the explanation for it too. He's like, I guess Smash Brothers.
Smash Brothers?
I'm like, that shit came out years ago. Why are they still getting votes?
Also, President Mike got a really big boost for some reason. Like, what did he do?
I mean, he was involved in that one battle that,
I guess,
Jiro was in, and she got a big boost, but I don't, yeah, that's, otherwise, I'm kind of clueless. Mm.
You know, there's little notes here, like, frickin' Sero got a rose up a fair amount, I guess, because of his role in the test. Mineta dropped a bit because I guess he was being more and more of a pervert.
It's like, I hate this guy. He's weird.
But top 10, Uraraka was actually 10th place. She's like the third out of the three women who were in the top 10, which is a bit of a surprise. Most surprising, though, is the fact that Jiro is like the most popular woman in the series. So we were kind of pulling for her when they announced this, and it's like, all right, awesome.
Yeah.
She gets to do more.
Yeah. It's a really exciting thing when you see a character you like a side character, particularly, is ranking in the popularity polls. Cause it usually gives the writers more of a reason to start including them in more things too. I also mm-hmm. really appreciate that Asui is also up there too at 9th.
Oh yeah.
She was, number one in America, or number two in America last year, so...
I think so, yeah.
It's nice to see she's gaining popularity, too. But yeah, it stands that amongst all the characters there, Jiro is probably the one that hasn't had any major role as of yet, and hopefully this is a chance for her to be included in a more significant manner into future arcs.
We also got the results of the English popular language poll, too. Mm-hmm. Toga was really popular
among
English voters. Third place.
Really love the Yandere shit going on.
I don't know.
On.
I like to think that we might have influenced a few
people.
It was
all the bird!
Oh, you love me! You love me!
Zacker, I'm going to stab you in the heart and we can be together forever!
Tokoyami also showed up in the top 10 on that poll, but not in the overall one.
Yeah. Asui made it on there too, so nice for her. Mm-hmm. She dropped a little bit, but still good to be on there. And,
1 and 2 for both were Bakugo and Midoriya, so. Yep.
And, same.
I'm honestly not surprised at all by the Japanese, top 6. Well, a little bit by Kirishima. But
yeah,
not
Kirishima's
too much.
A little surprising.
A little bit, but, you know, he did have that big role when they went and rescued Bakugo. He had a lot of character development there. So, not too big a surprise.
Yeah.
But, you know, freaking Bakugo, Midoriya, Todoroki, Aizawa. okay, this all makes sense.
Also, I fucking love the outfit Bakugo has in the color spread.
He looks so regal and barbaric.
It looks so perfect for him. Like, this is like one of those things where League of Legends introduces a skin where you're like, that should be the base skin. That should be the base one. This is better than their actual outfit.
Explosion King.
I'm like, Deku should, or Bakugo should dress like fucking Triple H in a WrestleMania entrance. He just needs a couple skull masks and shit, and he's perfect.
I hate you, Deku. Oh, God. Yeah. Over, I really like the two-page spread in general, though. That's some cool outfits that they're wearing. Except for All Might, who's just got a Buster sword in his regular outfit. Anyway, let's move on to the chapter proper. It's the finale of the fight between Deku and Bakugo at last.
Yes.
Last time, Deku surpassed his limits, went from 5% in full cloak to 8%. But it looked like he kind of had it in the bag, but as it turns out, Bakugo managed to, I guess, deflect or maybe even completely block the kick. And he then manages to use an explosion to kind of turn Deku's momentum against him. Knocks him away with another explosion. And then at the end of it, he just kind of does a but I'm not sure exactly how to describe it. Deku punches him. And we get this internal, you know, monologue from Deku, like, you know, just because I'm using shoot style to protect my arms and use my legs more, that doesn't mean I'm going to completely stop using them. So he does that to get a bit of a jump on Bakugo, but Bakugo manages to kind of lean into the punch and uses an explosion to twist them around, and then he pins Deku to the ground while grabbing onto the hand that punched him. And Bakugo wins.
It's an extremely cool sequence here. This is actually mm-hmm. a really entertaining kind of end to this fight. But yeah, like, Deku jumps into the air and goes for a punch. And Bakugo responds by blasting himself into the air. So then Deku's punch hits. Bakugo turns, grabs his sleeve, twists him in midair, and then explosions from the sky, just resulting in what almost looks like a meteor crashing into the earth. Like, just all the force of that explosion just propelling Deku straight into the ground. And it's such a cool-looking visual when you see it. I mean, maybe you could argue, like, oh, it'd be cooler, it's like a two-page spread. But I actually like the page we see it in, because you get all the action that kind of leads up to this essentially given to you in one two-page spread kind of deal. So it's really kind of cool to be able to visualize all that sequence of events. It also helps if you're like me and explosions are ridiculously awesome to you. But I thought it was a really kind of cool finale to this, both thematically and visually as well. Like, this is something that if the anime gets to this point, that's going to be a cool looking scene.
Yeah.
But yeah, Bakugo wins.
I love Emperor Dane in the chat's explanation. Bakugo used a super armor command grab as a counter. Yeah. So Bakugo wins their fight, and he then starts to kind of just like talk down to him. He says, you're using All Might's power, and even after making it your own, you still lost to me, so why did you lose? And at that moment, finally, someone intervenes. All Might steps in.
All right, maybe it was All Might.
Yeah. Maybe it was All Might, yeah. What was it? Who was it you thought was going to stop him?
Endeavor, maybe? I don't even remember. it's Goku. I thought he was showing up.
All Might apologizes to the two of them because, I guess specifically to Bakugo, because he didn't realize what the hell was going on with him. And Bakugo starts to let stuff out. He asks him, you know, this is ever since that sludge thing, why did you choose him of all people? And Amai, of course, says, well, even when he had no powers, he was more of a hero than anyone. I could tell you were strong. You were already on your way, so I decided to give him a chance to walk that path, too. And Bakugo says, I'm not strong, I'm weak. I wanted to be strong like you, but I was weak, and you wound up like that because of it. And All Might says, it's not your fault. And he says, you're strong, you're not weak, but I was distracted by your strength. I burdened you with it. I'm sorry, because you two are still a boy. And he explains that in his time being a hero, he has learned that, I love to win just like you, Bakugo, and like Midoriya, I strive to save those in need. If either aspect was missing, I could never have stood for justice in the way I did. Midoriya looks up to your strength, Bakugo, and Midoriya, Bakugo fears your spirit. You both just laid everything bare, so can't you see now, if you can learn to respect each other and lift each other higher, you can become the ultimate heroes, ones who save by winning and win by saving.
This
was something that I think that, in one way or another, I think that we are all waiting for. In terms of what was Bakugo's development leading to. Because we've been having some discussions about this, especially in the last few weeks while this fight's been going on, about Bakugo's violent nature and his determination to win above all else. And essentially what All Might says here is that, Deku is the selfless embodiment of heroics, but wanting to rescue someone and not having the strength to do so, it doesn't really work. And also having the strength to do so without the heart of doing what's right, that's also not the right way. You need both together. And them being rivals can allow them to learn that from each other if, Bakugo will stop treating Deku like shit, and if Deku will actually realize what Bakugo is going through.
It's really interesting. Fantastic speech, first and foremost. I particularly love the fact that All Might apologizes to Bakugo, not for anything particular, the fact that all this tension is there, but he apologizes for not realizing that all this stress was too much on him because he was a boy, too. Because here's the thing. All Might has been a mentor to Deku throughout this series. Almost every critical juncture in Deku's life, of the time we read the series, All Might has been there to guide him. But the thought has always been with Bakugo that he has strength, but he'll find his way. Or, he'll come around. Or, we just need to make sure that he doesn't stride to the side of the villainy or anything like that. He's always been kind of left to his own devices. I mean, he has teachers there, but he's never had that mentor figure. And I like All Might here realizing that it was a mistake to think that he could handle all that. Even though Bakugo is extremely powerful, even though he's very responsible, smart, and resourceful, he's still a child too, and he still has all these conflicting feelings, and part of that has been because he hasn't had that kind of mentorship. So that's awesome in and of itself, but I really love what they've kind of established here with the duality of these two characters. I think that helps in a lot of series to kind of create, superhero series, to create an idea of what your notion of a superhero is, You can always say, you can't have Superman without Batman. There are two sides that need to exist. You need to have the side that's idealistic. You need to have the side that's going to say whatever means necessary. And what we get here is something similar, but not exactly that. It's Deku having to learn that he has to want to win. He can't just be thinking always, oh, I got to get stronger and chase. He has to have that conviction to win. And at the same time, Bakugo has to realize that being strong doesn't only just mean winning. It means going above and beyond and finding a way to be stronger, to accomplish goals and things of that nature. So I like that they're showing that these guys are two sides of the opposite coin, but together they kind of embody what would make an amazing hero.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that, honestly, I'm kind of surprised wasn't alluded to more up to this point. Mm-hmm. And I think it actually makes it a little bit more satisfying to have it, to know it's like, okay, yeah, this is what you were going for. Because for a long time, it sort of seemed as though Deku was being sort of presented as the ideal personality for a hero. And Bakugo was the flawed one. But this take on that, I think, is a lot more satisfying because Bakugo's got to be, one of the protagonists if he's going to end up being a hero. He can't just be Deku's rival if they are striving towards the same goal. So each of them having something that the other lacks and having to indirectly teach each other, I think, really helps this.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that good rivalries are created off of. And now that it's kind of established firmly and completely that Bakugo isn't really going to be a villain, it's not like he's going to be the anti-hero who drifts into that side. They're kind of establishing him as, the side character. He's not going to be like Vegeta, where it's like, I have to turn you back to the light, or things like that. They're like, he just needs to
learn. We're going to get Majin Bakugo later on.
he just needs to learn that there's more to strength than just what he thinks there is right now, and he needs to learn from those people around him. I really like the way they kind of explained what each other envies and despises about one another at the same time. Like, I really like how they've... I mean, in a way, you could almost say it's a little thick the way they've laid it on, but I really like that they gave us kind of everything you need to digest to realize why these two characters are separate from one another, but why they need one another as well. Like, this fight, not just in this chapter, but the entire, you know, conflict between these two characters, and even going further back, it's kind of all built to this moment where you're like, oh, like, this is what Bakugo's future is. Like, this is what we're going to be getting for these two characters. Like, these two are almost in a way maybe going to become, like, dual protagonists. I imagine Deku's still going to be the lead character in all this, but this kind of builds you into the idea of, like, oh, okay, like, these two relationship is going to be a major theme of the entire series. And I really like what we got out of this. This seems to be a uniquely written kind of relationship.
And to cap everything off, Bakugo kind of drops down and puts his elbows on his knees and slumps his head down in his arms. Just, you know, doesn't let either of them see his face for pretty much the rest of the chapter. And he, again, you know, reiterates to Deku, who's like, you know, you got put on the fast track by the strongest guy here and you still lost. And Deku this time replies, I'll get stronger enough to beat you. And Bakugo then goes on to ask, who knows about this deal between the two of you? And they say, like, well, Recovery Girl and the principal and, you. So Bakugo says, all right, well, if you're still trying to hide it, then I won't say anything about this. I'm not gonna go and spill the beans like stupid Deku here. So, yeah, Bakugo is in on things now. It seems like this is something that's definitely been a long time coming. We'll get this with a couple other series this week. I know that, because this is one of our traditions for the year-end shows on Weekly Manga Recap, is me trying to guess what the series was at the beginning of the year, and we specifically noted at the beginning of this year, it's kind of hard to, they're not especially memorable moments that were left off or started off the year on. We've got like three this year that are very memorable moments. So I think the next year is going to be a lot easier than this one.
Yeah, almost certainly. But I really like what we got out of this. This is a very significant chapter. It makes a lot more sense now as to why Bakugo ends up winning this, because you kind of screw with some of the message here if Deku actually ended up winning. It goes to show that there's still something for both sides to really learn in this.
Right. And
yeah, I think this is a huge...
Deku, your lesson to learn is winning at all costs.
Stop
is being able to win no matter what. Well, you beat the guy who wins otherwise.
Yeah. And I think it's really just this is a chapter I think we're going to look back on in time goes on with this series and be like, this was a really significant chapter. You know, this is one of those world building chapters that really kind of firmly establishes what this is all about. So really like this chapter. And I feel like, All Might's speech here probably will make the top, nomination for best speeches of 2016.
All right. Moving on, we do not have a Fairy Tail chapter this week because the two magazines have different release schedules, different weeks that they take off at the end of the year. So instead we're going to do Boruto in the place we normally do it in. Boruto number 8, You'll Need to Do It. So this entire chapter is built around the Kage's getting their asses kicked. They almost defeat their enemy, and then that one scientist dude is like, I'll help, guys!
You're like, God damn it, you suck!
He absorbs the jutsu again. Like, Sasuke and Naruto do this ridiculous QB in Susanoo armor combo order to beat him down.
It's so lame, yet at the same time, stupidly awesome. Like
they form the Mega Dragon Zord, essentially.
Almost literally. Like, you're seeing the fucking nine-tailed fox walk around in Susanoo armor, like, swinging a katana around. And you're like, I'm fucking watching Power Rangers at this point. You're like, whatever. All right, cool.
And then Glass is dark. It's like, I've got a technique to shoot at that guy who's completely weakened now. He absorbs it, kicks their asses again. He actually absorbed shadow binding jutsu, too. So they're kind of fucked. They can't move. But Boruto was not captured by the technique. So he remembers what Sasuke told him, which was, you know, just in case, you know, if the five Kage and I manage to defeat him, it's great. But if we can't, if we're taken down or if we're in trouble, then you'll need to do it, Boruto. There is something only you can do.
If it's this lame-ass fucking Rasengan that he did a while back, I'm going to be like, lay, this dude had to be like, I had to fight against fucking Nine Tails in Susanoo armor, and one fucking Rasengan from nowhere took me out. I'd be like,
you are so weak, you're barely worth noticing. So you'll have the chance to. Honestly, there was a chapter of God, what was that goddamn series called?
Naruto.
The freaking demon. The one with the demons and all the girls with swords.
Oh, Claymore?
Claymore, yeah. The final battle of Claymore is like that, where the male lead, whose name escapes me at the moment, like, he is beneath the main villain's notice, so he manages to just attack her from behind in order to strike a critical blow while she's dealing with all of the, you know, strong fighters. It's essentially like that. I think that this is going to go down. It's like, you're freaking jutsu are so weak and pathetic that the guy will be like, no, that's not worth absorbing. And then it'll explode in his face and be like, oh, I should have absorbed that shitty technique. It's a very simple chapter.
Yeah. It's pretty simple. I'm hearing some people say this wasn't in the, the anime, the movie. And, sweet, I guess we're getting something original in this, finally.
Okay, well, that's that. We've spent less time talking about that than we would have spent talking about Fairy Tail, I'm sure.
Almost, undoubtedly.
Almost. Let's move on to Food Wars, Shokugeki no Soma. It's chapter 196. It's continuing the flashback into the past of Joichiro. Chapter 196 is Trailblazer. Pardon me. So Dojima explains that this is around the time that Saiba had started doing his weird experimental dishes with people. Try this, you know, getting Shiomi to try and be his guinea pig, or taking advantage of the girls who, you know, had a crush on him. And it started to eventually concern Dojima and Azami, the fact that he's making all these weird, disgusting mashup dishes. And they're like, why is he bothering to do that for? So Fumio comes up with this idea. Is like, oh, maybe it's that he is trying to come up with something to get into that contest. Oh, you mean the blue? which stands for Bishoku Leading Under 35 Entrance.
So catchy.
It must have sounded so much better in whatever.
Almost undoubtedly sounded probably better.
Sounds so awkward.
I'm just going to jump into my Bishoku Leading Under 35 Entrance contest.
Whatever that is. More contests happened between Joichiro and the other two. He kept on kicking their asses. And Dojima was kind of wondering, it's like, what is up with this guy? Because he seems normal a whole lot of the time. His skills are very polished. What is he doing all this weird stuff for? And all of a sudden, after Saiba into the blue, he was challenged by this weird guy with a weird haircut and weirder lips, who essentially said, how come you guys to be on it? I will challenge you, blah, 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 blah. Put your blue entry on the line against me. And Simon was like, well, you know what we could do instead? What, you've got all those people backing you up, because he's surrounded by like 30 people who are backing him up. So let's do a regiment de cuisine. And he's like, yeah, okay, fine. Well, go get your little dorm friends then. Simon's like, no, I'm going to take all of you on myself. And so, yeah, it's Simon versus 50 chefs. And he, you know, was picking them off one by one, beating them down. And she was just like, hey, come on, take me on 10 at a time. And just being completely ruthless, destroying them. And eventually, the ringleader was up and he was like, no, we want to forfeit. No excuses. Fight me with food. It's so weird when it's a cooking contest, when he's like, because this is essentially the moment where the martial arts master is beating up, you know, 10 people at a time, just picking up one guy and swinging them into the others. He's so dominant. But it's food!
it's too boring taking on one at a time. I'll take you on 10 at a time. And my thought process is like, well, that doesn't change anything. I mean, it's still 10 people's food being grated against your dish. If anything, this is an advantage to you because it means you don't have to cook 10 separate dishes anymore.
Shit, he saw through my scheme.
Fuck, I was really running out of ideas for recipes. There's only so many things I can make out of salmon. Surprisingly, it seems like it's versatile, but salmon mac and cheese, salmon steak, I'm done out of that. After that, I was done.
Oh, God. So, we get a flashback within a flashback at this moment to when he won a cooking competition prior to this. And he, you know, offered congratulations, or he, you know, tried to shake one of the other competitors' hands. Like, oh, you know, it was an honor going up against you, and we should do this again. And the guy was like, no, I knew I didn't stand a chance from the beginning. So why bother? There's no point trying. Attitude, you asshole. So in the present, Saiba grabs the ringleader and says, you know, you've never given a second thought to how hard it is to be a pioneer. You'll insinuate I've got it easy. Must be nice. If that half-assed determination is all you've ever had, then I don't want to hear another word about honest, hard-working students. If you're not even going to bother put on a plate, just quit, or I'll bury you for good. So, or I'll destroy you, basically. Yeah.
So this was his heel turn, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Give me some proper competition or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. He just came into the ring, and Apollo Creed was fucking hot-dogging it for 35 minutes living in America, and now he just fucking killed him. And now it's up to Rocky, who in this scenario is, Kaiba from Yu-Gi-Oh!
Kaiba?
To show up and take him down.
I don't know anything about cooking. I prefer to play card games.
But I hate you so much, America. And thus, he helps America.
Japanese.
He helps America win the Cold War.
Bandicoot's like, I knew you had it in you all the time, Kaiba.
Come on, buddy.
Oh, man. So, some bystanders who are watching the competition are like, normal people don't win like this. And that isn't how the old Saiba would have handled it either. Why, Saiba, why? Why, Saiba, why?
God, you son of a bitch! God damn it, Saiba! God damn it!
Not like this! That son of a bitch! He betrayed us all! Man. He didn't even use barbecue sauce in the recipe!
Oh, and a slobber knocker! He just bait him like a government mule! God damn it!
By God!
There you go.
Like, God damn it, stop making wrestling references. This is nothing like that.
Took an hour into the podcast before I got our first good wrestling reference in there.
Yeah, the 8:30 wrestling reference didn't happen until 9 o'clock. Shut up, guys.
Now we were a half hour late starting up, though, so I guess this is about on par.
So Dojima, you know, in his narration says, that was the first time I ever saw Joichiro cook without smiling. But he looks over and sees a zombie going, that's amazing. So this is where we start to see the two diverge. is apparently, it seems as though Joichiro was taking this approach to things, and he eventually probably realized he shouldn't have, and Uzumaki's like, no, that was fucking awesome. Very much a Kylo Ren, Darth Vader kind of thing.
Yeah.
Honestly. Except Saiba didn't, you know, die before. Anyway. He had always been given adulation, called many things, a true genius, a pioneer, a revolutionary, a creator of fine taste. But that day, Joichiro earned a new nickname. Shura, the Demon. There's a really cool two-page spread of Joichiro essentially standing over the fallen corpses of his victims with this very intense look in his eyes. This is where the Shokugeki no Soma is at its best, when it's like, cooking!
It's weird, because like they try to make it like this dramatic like spread, and it is cool, but the one thing that catches my eye is like the fact that his little hair rat, like his little...
He's evil, is that his hair is unkempt when he's with the hair tie out.
But you still see it, like, floating in his hand, like it's, like, an instrument of death or something. Like, it almost, like, it'd be, like, a subtle knife or something like that. You're just like, wait, that's just your hair tie. You're scrunchie, essentially.
Haircuts are very important for determining villainous and heroic allegiances, Chris. That's why Seamus grew a mohawk, and that's why Neville shaved the sides of his head.
Nick, we already got to the 9 o'clock wrestling reference. We're good.
We didn't have an episode last week. I have no limit this week.
That is true. You could be all over the place.
I also think that it's kind of weird that, you know, he's drawn that way while he's wearing, you know, his student's chef outfit, which is not the most imposing piece of attire one could be wearing.
Yeah, no, not particularly.
That's it for Food Wars, so... yeah, cool little moments, honestly. I'm looking forward to what's coming out of this, honestly. I don't know. Flashbacks where it's like, you know, really compelling, but then there's some where it's like, okay, that's interesting, and I kind of get this, but I want to see just how it ends and then get to the main story again. And this is a little bit closer, I think, to the latter than the former for me.
Yeah, I'm not crazy pumped about this stuff yet, but that's mostly just because I have had very little interest or intrigue towards Joichiro as a character. I'm all for it, but at this point, he's just not a character I'm all that invested in. So, we shall see.
Alright. So, we're out of jump starts now. With all of the different series that ended this year, I'm sure that we'll be getting a fair share of them every few weeks or so. Or every couple of months, I guess. But none this week. So, we're just going to head straight into the Promised Neverland. Last time, Crone revealed that she had overheard the children talking about their escape plans. And so now she is confronting them and has offered them an alliance, which is the chapter title, Alliance. Cover page is really cool. Very sinister-looking Crone pinning butterflies to a display case. So she makes that offer, and Emma is immediately like, what the fuck is she on? And Norman instead thinks, ah, okay, yeah, I got you. So he's like, yeah, we'll hear you out. And what results from all of this is Crone laying things out like, oh yes, you know, I want to become the mom of this house, and you children want to go free. And if you go free, then I can, you know, make Isabella look bad. She'll lose her mom position. I'll get to take her place. And that will be my way to gain freedom, because we're all prisoners of the system. Even the sisters and moms. And this is the best way to go about things, is for me to become a mom. And she actually reveals some very important information, which is that girls who fulfill certain conditions and live until 12 years old are presented with two paths when they are about to be shipped. One, to continue and die, become a mom.
This is
some choice.
Yeah, well, this is interesting, because this is stuff that we've had, I don't know, we've never actually directly had this, but it's something a lot of people have been talking about for a while. Like, we've never had any confirmation before that the mom position was solely for women. Like, there was never anything saying there were specifically, there are no dads out there. We just didn't see any until this point. But this is her saying, confirming what everyone's noticed, like, hey, we've never seen adult males here, and that's because the option to become a mom, as people have suggested, is something that happens when someone reaches the age in the facility, they're given the opportunity to become one. But also that it's not offered to men as well, it's only given to moms, or to women, right. So they're only moms.
Don would be a great mom.
Yeah. I think Phil will be an amazing mom. But yeah, it's interesting because this is some detail we've not necessarily known before, but have been speculating about for a while.
So Gilda asks, like, what are the conditions, by the way, for this? And she says you have to have a grade above a certain number, and you also must have the mom's recommendation. With those two requirements, you can survive without escaping if you're a girl, but I don't recommend that path. They'll make it so you'll never be able to leave. And she undoes her blouse a bit and reveals that she's got this scar in her chest. Another chip is implanted, a chip in her heart, which if an adult steps 1 foot outside of the farm, an electrical current will be sent through this, her heart will stop. At the same time, if another reason makes her heart stop, it acts as a transmitter that notifies the higher-ups, which is another important piece of information, because that means that they can't kill Crone and Mom in order to escape. So Crone gives this very big sob story. She says, you know, I only can live in the farms, and that's why I want to live the best possible way. As a mom, even if it's fake, live like a human. Playing house as a mother, surrounded by a warm family, cute children, and their adorable love for me. But you can't, of course, can't do that with Isabel on the way, so she proposes, oh, you know, if you escape, that would be beneficial to me, and then we'll get rid of Isabella. We have the same enemy, so we should cooperate together. And Norman's like, she's full of shit. Because yeah. Of course she is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
when, like, 90% of the chapters that she's been in the past, like, 3 months have been her, like, around a corner being like... Like, just, like, creepily staring on things and smiling. Then you're like, yeah, I'm guessing as a reader I'm not supposed to think she's on the up and up.
So, Norman surmises that the reason why Mom isn't turning them in is because she actually has no evidence. So... whatever, what she can, and also she is not trusted more by the demons than Mom. So her only choice is to get close to us, get close and obtain evidence. And then, yeah, and of course inside her head, Crone's thinking, like, yes, I'll get close enough to obtain evidence. I'll ship the annoying brats out along with Isabella for her failure, and then I'll become the mom. So that's it. And she even knows that Norman probably knows that's what she's up to. So it's nice. It's a really interesting dynamic where it's like both sides know that they're lying to and using the other. So it's a very different setup for this. Just like we know that you're fucking with us. We know you know that we know. Oh God. But yeah, Norman is like, okay, so she's going to, yeah, she is doing this basically just so that she can gain our trust, so that then she can get close enough, so that she can gather evidence, so that she can kill us. And she failed to do that with Gilda by having her try and turn against us, so she's just approaching us as a group instead. And even if she can't get the evidence, if she lets us escape, she can then get rid of Mom still. So, yeah, and... It's like they're having a conversation, even though they're just having their own internal monologues with each other. They know that, like, each of them knows how suspicious Crone is and how obvious they are to the other. But Crone is like, okay, yeah, let's join forces. And Norman's like, well, it's still beneficial to us, even if she is going to find a stab in the back. So he starts to accept her offer and reach his hand out towards her. But Emma is so straightforward and blunt that instead she says, hang on a second, you know, I agree, yeah, that we should accept your help, like Norman says, but I want to make sure of something. What's the guarantee you won't betray us? She gets really intense again, like the way that she looked at Ray when she was trying to guess if he was going to stay honest with them again. And Crone tries to play it off as coy, and Emma demands an answer, straightforward, and Crone says, Ray.
If Ray tells on me to Mom, you can destroy me. But if I tell Mom what Ray's really been doing, I can destroy him. So neither of us will betray the other because we can't. In a bit of a very tightly wound situation, mutually assured destruction, essentially, is the only thing that's keeping them from taking advantage of the other at this moment.
What's the guarantee you won't betray us? Because I'll fuck you over if you do, if I do. And you'll fuck me over. It's like, oh, okay.
Good point. Dawn asks if Krone was raised on the farm, and she says, yeah, the same Gracefield house, but not here on Plant 3. So this,
This is like in the last episode of Westworld, where they find out there's another park, and it's just like, oh, Samurai World! I mean, that was...
It's something that was suspected even within the series, but to have absolute confirmation, this is not the only farm in the world, is nice world building.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of almost have to expect it, but yeah, there's a lot of stuff within this chapter that's kind of confirmed that a lot of us already sort of expected, but it's good to get that confirmation because it keeps everybody on the same page.
Krone gets close to Dawn and Gilda and like kind of pats Gilda on the head, and says, "Oh, by the way, don't be frightened. You know, I'm not mad at you. In fact, I'm grateful because it was because you two made waves that I was able to specify the targets. Anyway, bye."
Peace.
Like, wow, I got to feel kind of shitty right now, don't they? Norman tries to reassure everyone's like, this is actually good for us. You know, we can use her, we can take advantage of her. But Emma catches on to something that Krone says, which was she said that she wanted to live in the best way possible. She was one of us. But she thinks that to continuing to watch children get killed is the best way to live. That's a way for humans to live. Wants to be a mom. She really doesn't think anything of the lives of us children. So, I really like that little bit. It's really nice to see, especially the contrast between Emma and the two boys. Because they keep pointing out, it's like, oh yeah, she's really smart, but she really thinks more with her heart than her head a lot. Mm-hmm. Norman's like, oh yeah, she's a great tool. And Ray's like, oh yeah, we can take advantage of this. And it was like, that fucking bitch.
I'll murder her face.
Norman kind of brings everything around, like, okay, yeah, we know what she's planning. We know all this and stuff, but we should still try and take advantage of this. As long as we don't give her evidence, she'll have no choice but to let us escape because she doesn't have authority and trust over Mom. The only thing that she can help right now is if she gets evidence from us. So let us escape if we can kind of manipulate this relationship the right way. So let's just try and focus on playing it like that. Yeah. So Emma and Norman that night go to Krone's room in order to get some more information about the world. And that's where the chapter ends.
This is an interesting chapter. I think, honestly, what has me most intrigued out of all this is not actually the information we got, but the information that we don't have that this then implies. Because this is, even though it's complete horseshit, this is Krone explaining why she wants to overthrow the current mom, why she wants to take over. And she tries to, you know, she gives her whole reason, like, oh, it's the best life I can make out of the situation I'm in, and I do it for the kids. And, you know, all the kids at this point, at least Emma and Ray, or Norman rather, they're like, well, that's horseshit. I know that's horseshit. And we as readers are like, yeah, probably horseshit. But what this kind of puts into your mind is like, well, I know that's bullshit. But what's Mom's actual goal in everything? Like, what does Mom want? Is she just, I'm going to keep my position, I want to live as comfortably as possible, or is there another motive? Because Mom seemed, and has seemed, very shrewd and tactical in everything she does, and it almost makes you wonder if she doesn't have some plan in work, some overall goal. Like, especially as you find out here that the moms are all bombed and strapped like everybody else, like all the kids are. So it's a situation where the moms themselves are kind of prisoners in the same way. They're just the wardens of the prison, but they're subject to the same rules. So I know there are people who have had theories, some saying that maybe mom's actually trying to help the kids escape or things like that. And that I think this actually helps to lend maybe more credence to that notion of maybe mom's actually an ally or things like that. Because we've seen what someone who's trying to impose the idea of being an ally to these kids would be like with Crone right here. Now I'm starting to think, like, I wonder what would actually happen. I wonder what's really going on. It just makes me think and question what mom's motives in all of this are, because obviously we're learning some details now, and we don't have enough details to figure out, like, huh, I wonder what her stake in all this is.
I'll have more to say about deception when we get to our talk about One Piece.
Okay. That is fair enough.
Yeah. Let's talk about Black Clover. This is another really straightforward chapter. I don't think we're going to talk about this one too much longer than we're going to talk about Boruto, honestly. Page 91. The fight going on between fucking everybody is still going on, of course. Explosive enthusiasm. Mars has just decided to side with Fanzel, his own teacher, against the Diamond Kingdom. What's his face? The absorption guy is just like, oh, this is great. This means that I can kill you now because you're a traitor. Sweet. He goes on this long rant about how, yeah, he gets to kill him, he gets to kill his teacher. The assassin girl tries to, kill him, and he's like, ah, you're a little wussy magic, can't cause anything, whatever. Absorbs all the magic that they're throwing at him. Fanzel's like, by the way, Mars, why did you sign with us? I thought your memories were erased! Like, thank you for that exposition. He just says, the details can wait. Okay. He then explains that there are certain things that can defeat their opponent. Get him magic until it overwhelms his capacity and shorts him out, like with spirit magic or the Witch Queen's power. The other is anti-magic. And Fenta's like, okay, we should lead him over to Asta. Okay. So they do that. Asta is still fighting with Fauna with her salamander magic. She shoots a huge fireball at them. Fanzel gets Asta's attention and is like, hey, deflect it this way. And so he does, and he shoots this giant fireball, and it goes, and boom. And that's...
I forgot most of this chapter, to be completely honest.
It's
reading through it again.
Not an incredibly
reading through it again. I guess the only thing to really truly take for this is like, well, I kind of hope this is it for most of us. I mean, I guess there's still technically what's her name, Svenra, what
Fauna.
I guess she's still out there. We haven't completely resolved that yet. But I'm kind of the hope of, like, let's finish this stuff up, because I'm at the point now where it's just like, I'm not really sure what's going on. I'm just kind of following the motions right now, and yeah. I'll mention, this was just recently announced that Black Clover is getting an anime, and I know a lot of series nowadays, like Jump series, they'll get animes, and a lot of them, they don't last an incredibly long amount of time. You know, I think the anime industry as we kind of know it doesn't exist the same way it used to. You know, we're not going to get 90 seasons of most series. You know, World Trigger ended after only a few. I think it's up, Toriko didn't get a full run. Bleach didn't finish its run. Like, it doesn't happen all the time. And yeah, people are saying it's already not getting a great studio. But I really question how a Black Clover anime could run, because it's really not a series. Like, I feel like it's going to have a lot of padding to it and things of that nature, because it's not that dense of a series. Like, I guess it helps that Asta wins every fight in basically the same way, because they can just reuse that animation over and over again. But, you know, save a couple bucks. But I'm really curious to see how an anime adaptation for this is going to go, because I don't think there's that much to it, really. We shall see. I'm really kind of hoping this arc ends sooner rather than later.
I mean, I have, I usually have plots to, you know, I was like, oh, hey, this chapter, Black Clover's like, it was like just so little to this, like it, I'm not even mad, it's just like, who cares? Like, oh, you did that. It's getting tired, honestly. It's like, oh, look, these guys who were having this fight decided they needed Asta to beat him, and then Asta did.
Yeah, it would be nice to get conclusions that feel different than what they tend to always end up being. But hey, you know, we did get other stuff. We did get some time with Zell and things of that nature. You know, we did get things that were different than the usual affair. It's just the environment that this is taking place in, the results of it, all of it has felt very similar. And the way that they essentially beat this villain who was kind of getting built up in an exciting way in a rather predictable manner. Like, hey, let's knock his own shit back at him. It's like, all right.
Okay.
All right, so...
Ruby!
Yeah, we're going to talk about Ruby real quick. Ruby, Chapter 8. And I've been hearing people say to me... I've actually had people send us emails saying, just drop the Ruby manga, because we don't have much to say about it a lot of times, things like that.
Yeah, you have no context, you didn't watch the series.
Well, it's actually not even people saying that so much. It's people saying that the manga just doesn't really have much to offer in many ways, and if you're not able to pick up what it's doing, then it's weird. I'm fine with reading it, because I do hope that I can kind of get into it, but this is sort of a weird chapter to say that on, because I have some thoughts on this one. But last time, Yang, who is, I guess, the Y in our Ruby quatret, is, I believe it's some lair of, like, a criminal underground guy, and is fighting two assassin women, the Malachite sisters, and I guess these are the only characters thus far who are actually proving to be, like, some kind of actual challenge for one of the lead characters. It's not like a mindless army of zombies or robots or whatever. And it's kind of this interesting scene, because Yang's fighting the women, and the mafioso, like, comes down, and he's holding this giant cannon. And he's holding it like, I'm trying to... Alright, here's a shoe, essentially. And he's holding it like this. But imagine that this was, like, 700 pounds, and he's holding it... Actually, no, sorry, the other hand's here. So he's holding the entire thing with just his fingers, like, based on the back of it. And I think it's Yang who says, "What did you do to the laws of physics?" And I'm like, hold on. You can't say that here when 90% of the shit you guys are doing in this series does not follow the rules of life physics at all. This could happen. If this dude was that absurdly bullshit strong, he could potentially hold it at a place that it was. I mean, it would be immensely powerful if he needed, but it's still technically possible.
There is that he does shoulder it properly, so I'm trying to figure out what the fuck Yang is saying that in response to.
I think it's because in that first shot, it's maybe it is supposed to be resting on his leg, but I think it's just hovered in the air at the start of it. And maybe that's what she's questioning? I don't know. Or maybe she's questioning where it came from. I don't know. I just felt like it was weird for her to question, like, physics don't work that way. Now, hold on. I'm going to backflip 7 times.
I'm going to use my shotgun gauntlets to stop you.
My flaming shotgun gauntlets. So she fights back, and he basically grabs, like, a small bit of her hair and pulls it out. Like, in, like, the bounce, like, in, like, his flying backwards. And he's like, sorry, tore some out, didn't I? And we cut away. So, if you don't recall this, Yang, I guess, is Ruby's sister. I don't know if biological or adoptive sisters, but they're sisters. And it's a conversation Yang has with her where she's like, your hair's so black and shiny and pretty. And Ruby says, your blonde hair's really pretty too, Yang. It's like a burning dragon. And Yang's like, what?
I love you. I love that note. This chapter is so much more memorable because of those two little things that Yang says. You know, that first of all, what'd you do with the laws of physics, which I still am confused by. But yeah, where Ruby's like, it's like a burning dragon. It's like, wait, what?
Why? And she's like,
burning
what kind
of free fire?
What kind of compliment's that? And we cut to now, you know, the present fight again, where she's, I guess, heating up her fire gauntlets. And she's like, now you've done it. And I guess she's really, really angry that someone tore out her hair.
My hair?
I don't know. Here's
Son
the thing.
Of a bitch.
Here's the thing. This can be a thing. Like, it's a big character point for Josuke in part 4 of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. He's like, I have this hairstyle. You don't fucking insult his hair. Like, it's something introduced in the first chapter. Someone starts to insult and they're like, no, no, you don't insult that guy's hair. And you don't know why, but they make it a clear point. Like, he changes if you insult it. And then later on, you find out the context. Here, we're, I guess, getting the context is, like, her sister liked her hair and made a comment about it, so she's really protect. But I can't tell. Like, is it... It doesn't seem like it's that meaningful of a comment to have this much, like, for that to be her berserk button, essentially. Like, it just seems really arbitrary in this. Like, I'd be fine if it was like, my sister loved my hair and it's the last thing she loved before she fucking died or something like that. But suppose, like, my sister really loved her hair and I'm gonna go have lunch with her after this. Then I'm like, why do you care? What's the point? It's just sort of weird in that. Anyway, she continues to fight and it doesn't end there. She's still fighting the sister's chapter ends. I've kind of been letting Ruby sit and dwell on me for things here, and I understand that this is a series that is a manga adaptation of another series, that this is a prequel to that series, that this is also a retelling of vignettes from that series, and that watching the series is probably very different. But just from reading this, I'm definitely starting to pick up on the writing style of Ruby, and I'm not particularly fond of it. It's, you know, obviously the people who are writing this are very inspired by anime, manga, and video games. You could tell that all over the place. But this particular execution, I don't know if we're just not being given enough details or information. I just don't get it. Like, I don't get what Yang's character's really supposed to be or what's going on. You know, when it came to, like, Weiss, you know, I got what her character was about. I got all of her details. I could see what they were going for with Yang. I'm just like... she's a spunky, punch-you-in-the-face character who is really possessive about her hair, I guess, and she's fighting thugs in a... Like, I just don't get what's going on here, and nothing seems to really be helping to that goal. So...
Well, you know, the part, you could, I guess, use the excuse of, oh, there's these... It's a retelling of stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. But Boruto, from what we've been told, is... a retelling of the Boruto film, but that series, we've gotten a pretty firm grasp of what the hell is going on. Like, we know what the central conflict is, we've gotten to know the important characters in it, things to say about Boruto's shitty personality, especially to begin with, but we knew what the hell was going on with them. With Ruby, it's just like, I have no idea what the hell is going on with any of these characters. And it's been going on for 2 months now. They're short chapters, but...
And they end off at weird parts, too. Like, they end off on moments where you're like, that's the end? Like, nothing happened. This chapter ends up on two characters blocking one another. That's it.
I mean, if... I guess if you want to just say, like, oh, yeah, you know, this is for Ruby fans who want to, you know, I guess have this this retellings or, you know, just kind of... It's bonus content and you can only enjoy it if you're a fan. But honestly, like, it's weird that it's running in Jump with this presentation. It really feels like it was a chance to, cause, you know, like with us, it's a chance for it to introduce itself to people who aren't familiar with the series. But when you then, never mind.
No, I get what you mean. Like, this is a chance for us to be introduced to it, and you kind of wonder, like, what's the point of this if it's not appealing? Like, I understand. A lot of people love Ruby. I watched a little bit of it, and I was like, eh, it's not for me. But I looked at the manga as a chance to be like, well, let me explore more than just what I saw in my initial viewing of it. Is the only reason this manga is really popular and successful is because people who already watch and enjoy Ruby, like, read and enjoyed this manga? Because I feel like that's the only way you can like this. Like, I get that these are all vignettes. I know people are explaining this to me over and over and over, and I grasp that what's going on. Like, these are tellings of the vignettes that are mostly, like, dialogue lists or things like that that have stuff added on. But as it is, as you said, we're 2 months into this, and I can't tell you much of what's going on. Where's the prequel in this? What's happening? Why are these chapters ending in such weird places? Like, I can appreciate that there's art and, like, a style to this that indicates, you know, compelling action, things like that. And maybe, ultimately, you should never bother reading this and just watch the series if you're actually interested in seeing it. But as it's being presented to us, what is happening? What is this manga telling us? Who are these
Apparently these are based on, like, teaser trailers for the series proper, in which case, what kind of bullshit, awful teaser trailers were these?
But yeah, I mean, well, that's also the sense that you could watch something that was 2 minutes long, you got this, I mean, I'm gonna fucking make enemies here, but fuck it. The trailers, I watched all of them, and the thing that they were meant to get you excited about is like, holy shit, look at her way of fighting! Because that was all they did. They were just fight trailers. They didn't really give you much more than that. It's not like they were like, holy shit, you're going to see this character and all their complexities. It was like, that chick punches people with a shotgun gauntlet! Cool, brah! And that was it. And that's fine, but, like, that's what those were. So, when you get it here, and you're not actually watching the animation, you're just seeing it in the still images, you can't even kind of get that either. So you're just like, what's happening? What's going on? Like, we were explained at the start of the series.
I should go on a rant about Homestuck and how awful it is so that I draw some of the heat off of you.
I'm not shitting completely on Ruby. I don't. If people like Ruby, that's perfectly fine. Again, I only watched a little bit of it, but I watched the teasers. I watched the vignettes originally, and that's what they were. And this manga doesn't carry most of that over because it can't show us the animation, which was, quite honestly, ultimately the biggest reason I think people wanted to watch Ruby. I feel like if it didn't have that crazy action that was so signature to Monty Oom's style, people wouldn't have cared, because it's not as though it was a world that was all that original. It's not as though these are characters that are all that original. It's all that stuff, all the rest of the stuff around this is, as I said, it's written by people who are highly inspired by manga and anime and video games. And that's all great, but when the main appeal of this can't be portrayed in this medium, and you're looking for something else, there's just not really there.
Hmm. Okay. So, all that said, let's talk about One Piece.
My great chapter, though. The best chapter of all time. This is my chapter. Nick, I'm just going to cut us off now.
Talk about how shitty Ruby is, but this is a good chapter.
I'm like, this is the best chapter of all time, though. I love Ruby.
Oh, man. Okay. Piece, chapter 850, A Ray of Light. Okay. So, we open up with Chopper and Karen making their way through the mirror world. They're actually taking Brûlé around with them, with the steam locomotive guy kind of carting them around. And one of them makes a comment, Chopper makes a comment that they can only actually go through the mirrors while they're touching Brûlé. So they can make their way around the whole city as much as they want, but in order to exit, they actually have to have her with them. So they're kind of lugging her unconscious corpse around while they do so. I do like the detail at the beginning because, you know, they're poking their heads through various mirrors and stuff, and Carrot sticks, you know, looks through a mirror into a girl's shower, and then Chopper sticks his head into a man's shower.
Oh, it's not even just a man's shower. It's this dude with this enormous face, butt chin, hairy all over, and he has a much more exaggerated expression. I love that payoff of, like, you could have gone for the easy fan service joke, but it's paid off in a better joke afterwards.
Yes, exactly. I also like how, you know, nonplussed Kara's reaction is when she looks at the girl's shower, but Chopper's, like, horrified when he looks.
She's like, not here. Chopper's like, what the fuck are you?
We cut to Sanji's guest room where he has finished making a little bento box for pudding. He's made a whole lot of food for her. Like, a whole lot. There's something like 4 meat dishes that he's done. And he's like, oh shit, I've made way too much for her. Oh well, I'll eat the leftovers, I guess.
It's like a fucking, like, leg of ham is just, like, hanging out of it. You're just like,
just sticking out of it.
You're just like, is that it go in a traditional bento usually?
Oh god. He kind of gets this idea into his head, like, oh, you know, pudding will feed me the leftovers. Ooh. He's all love struck, and he heads out to go and visit her. head over to the prison library where Nami and Luffy are still being captive. Luffy is struggling mightily against his bonds. He's struggling so hard that he looks like he's actually going to tear his arms off. Nami's like, what are you doing? You're going to hurt yourself. And Luffy says, I would rather lose my arms than be dead, and there's no other way out of here. So if we just sit here, then we're going to lose everything, and Big Mom will kill us. So come on, Nami, you rip your arms off too.
I do like that, because it would be so easy to just play this at the idea that, like, Nami's, like, the you know, female damsel, like, desperately not wanting to see, like, the male character be hurt trying to get out. But she's actually just annoyed. She's like, I don't want to watch you rip your arms. Like, she's just like an annoyed sister at this point. She's like, I don't want to see you rip your arms off. Oh, God. Like, fine, I'll just turn away.
Come on, Nami, you rip your arms off too. No!
Like, I love that there's a relationship they have where she's just like, I'm so tired of watching you try to rip your arms off. God damn it.
We then cut over to Pedro and Baron Tamago, who are having engaged in battle. We also are introduced to their bounties. Pedro's got a 382 million berry bounty. Tamago's got a 429 billion.
Which is weird, because that used to be an absurdly high number, but we've been recently running into characters with, like, the billions of berries, or...
It's still a significantly high amount, though.
Oh, yeah.
Luffy was below that until this most recent encounter with Doflamingo, so... Mm-hmm. Backstory and exposition to their time together. First off, Pedro and Peckham's and a third pirate named Zeppo all knew each other. All three of these beast men, but they were caught by Big Mom, who Pedro and Zeppo were. And she spun a roulette wheel to determine their punishment with her soul-taking ability. And Zeppo was killed by it because 100 years of his life was taken away. And so then she goes on to say, like, yeah, he only had 30 left, so that means that you owe me 70 more years. So let's do it.
Now, something to remember, this same wheel was introduced back when Jinbei showed up and said he wanted to leave the Big Mom Pirates. She said that's the punishment. So we haven't seen anything since then at all. Mm-hmm. But, it's kind of interesting to see.
So Peckham's, you know, cried and begged for Mom to have mercy on Pedro. And she was like, oh, fine, I'll knock 10 years off if you cry. But the price for taking Tamago's eye is heavy, so 60 years, no less. And Pedro took his own eye out and offered it to her and said, you know, how many years does this knock off? Because the day of the dawn of the world is nigh, and I must return home. So Big Mom took a little bit of mercy and said, hey, I like that. So we'll just take 50 years off. But, of course, you know, if it went from 60 to 50, that means Pedro cannot have long left on his life. So, meanwhile, as we're getting this flashback, of course, Tamago and Pedro are fighting with each other. And Tamago is taunting Pedro because even though Pedro is using a sword, he's got superior reach because he's from the Long Leg tribe. And also, he is wearing tights that block Mink's electro power, so those aren't doing Pedro any good either.
Yes, indeed. You cannot match my superer reach. On top of that, my superior reach. On top of that, I'm wearing the tights that block your electro powers. Legs Benedict.
Just says it straight up.
Without much Legs Benedict.
Legs Benedict.
Like, for such a reach of a fucking amazing pun, you'd think he'd say more inflection to it.
Oh, I get it like eggs. Oh, I never thought of it like that.
Oh, wow, man. That was something I never even considered before. Now answer, Moe, Pedro.
Moe?
Why return to the Isle of Magmas? Do you remember? I'm trying to remember. I think it was like the program that existed for like learning disabled kids. I feel like the Get Ahead program or something like that. They used to have commercials for it, and it'd be like a kid in third grade, and he'd be like, "All right, now read the sentence." He's like, "They went to the it is land," and all the kids in class just start fucking laughing at him. I know it was meant to be like, this kid just doesn't know. He doesn't know. But I was like, oh man, I wish I was there, because we just beat the shit out of that kid for so long, just verbally, like, fucking Island, you dumb as shit. Point and laugh at him for like 20 minutes straight.
Oh god. So, Pedro explains that he came back here because the Straw Hat Crew saved my homeland and I owe them my life. And I am certain that they will one day guide the world to a new dawn. They will surpass you all and change the world. So there's no better way to use the last remnants of my life than their service. But don't get me wrong, I'm not dying here. They haven't fulfilled their reason for being here yet. I'm not dying yet. And he suddenly lunges forward and slashes Tamago in half.
Legs Benedict!
Splits him open like an egg. Splits him open like an egg, and a freaking yolk flies out.
Well, I think we're meant to get the implication now he has an egg-based devil fruit of some kind.
Yes.
If not evidenced from the eggshell he wears as pants, and from Legs Benedict, this definitely seals the deal.
Yeah, the yolk flying out of his body.
He's like, oh, my internal organs! Oh, and my egg whites!
Oh, my yolk!
My yolk! Yolk.
So, we cut over to Sanji again. He is trying to get into Pudding's room, but there is a living door that is refusing to let him inside, saying that Pudding is currently indisposed. And Sanji's like, well, I want to give her something. No! Go away before I slam in your face!
It's like, but you're already closed. Get the fuck out!
Go away! So he's just like, oh, well, I think that there's a veranda outside Pudding's room, so I'll just go, outside and enter in that way. And so, yeah, he exits and, makes his way through the rain. And he even is kind of getting a little bit embarrassed. He's like, well, I don't know, this is kind of like peep. I don't know if this is appropriate. Oh, but no. I mean, we're going to be husband and wife tomorrow. It's not going to be a crime if she's changing her naked. Oh, God, Sanji. You're still gross. He hears Pudding laughing inside of her room when he gets to her window. And then he's like, oh, wait, she's talking to someone. Wait, that's Reiju. What's Reiju doing in there? And why is she with... And
then
Pudding...
Chris was right!
Chris... Oh my god.
And then Chris was right!
You put down your stone cold lock of the century of the week on this, and oh my god. Okay, so Pudding reveals that she is a triclops. She's got a third eye, and she is laughing over the possibility that she would ever want to marry that stupid thug, Sanji. And Sanji, of course, is shocked when he hears this. And she, Pudding is... gloating in Reiju's face, saying, I'm Mama's favorite, especially when it comes to my acting. Doing all those favors and bowing and scraping got so annoying. Still, it's so easy to fool men when Mama asks me to. Those Straw Hats never stood a chance. Only my family knows what I'm really like. You all bought it! It was me, Sanji! It was me all along, Sanji!
I'll destroy my company. Me! And the
every last one of you bought it.
Oh,
even your family, even your immediate family bought it. Oh god. We get a flashback to when Pudding was whispering to Luffy and Nami, and just as I suggested, yeah, she was just saying like, "Oh yeah, I'm gonna have you guys be killed," and then walked off fake crying while laughing in their faces, and that's why Luffy got pissed off and wanted to escape. I'm glad we had that chapter because it gave me a little bit of time to brace for this.
You know, it was a weird turn of events because the last chapter I was like, all right, someone bring Baron Tamago over so I can crack open this egg and just get it all over my face. Because clearly I was the big idiot who read way too much into a scene and wasn't paying enough attention. And now...
And I was like, no, I don't know. I think this actually improves your chances.
And now I'm taking that egg, I'm scraping it off my face, and I'm using it to make a pie, a humble pie, and I'm filling it with eggnog and blow. Because I was right, goddammit, for once. I might die from my eggnog blow pie, but goddammit, it's going to be worth it.
People are throwing around the idea that there is... more even to this than meets the eye, which, I mean, I mentioned briefly wanting to talk about deception when Promised Neverland came up. And that's what I love about this. Once you have a character revealed to be a liar, that means you can't trust anything that they do. As big a liar as Pudding has revealed herself to be. Because we don't know still everything that's going on. We haven't gotten the full explanation. Like, how did Reiju get hurt? Why is she there talking with Pudding? What's going on, exactly? We don't know. And anything that Pudding had said at this point, we still wouldn't be able to trust because she's shown herself to be a complete and total liar. She says some stuff about how, she... Yeah, apparently she says that she is Mama's favorite. But we also had that flashback when she remembered, Oh gosh. Her name's escaping me. Nami's friend.
Lola.
So what did that conversation that she had actually mean to her? Because that was, you know, her internal thoughts. That was not her trying to deceive anyone. Why did she think about that? What was that making her thinking? So people are like, oh, maybe she's, you know, trying to do something for herself. Or, oh, maybe she's trying to do, you know, she's actually going to be deceiving Mama and all of this. I don't know about any of that, but this is so much more interesting. This makes Pudding a much more memorable character and a much more interesting character that she's got this side to her where she is, you know, this complete liar who has fooled all the Straw Hats and landed them in this situation as a result.
I'm going here mostly as part of, you know, the gag that it turned out that
I was right.
seems to have come true. I'm fully open to the idea that maybe there's a triple cross. I don't think there is. I think there's enough evidence to suggest
I don't think there is. There might be something where Pudding is trying to gain something from this for herself and not just to further Mama's plan.
But I'm open to that idea. But I think ultimately what this is. Definitely a more interesting direction to take things. Because as it was before, we were kind of getting set up in one clear sort of direction, and Pudding was just one of those other, like, not anonymous, but just very interchangeable, you know, female, like, damsels within whatever plot of the week we're in, or whatever arc we're in at the moment. You know, she didn't feel all that distinctly different from, say, like, a Canis or a Shirahoshi or things of that nature, you know, or Rebecca. This obviously puts a twist on that because she's turning out to be a villain, and it makes a lot of sense given what we know about Big Mom and her way of doing things, you know. The fact that she's like, no, Big Mom doesn't care about marrying into the Vinsmokes. She just wants all your science and everything like that, and like the idiots you were, you came to her kingdom. You came to a place surrounded by her army. And you thought you'd just walk out with all the power you wanted? No, we're about to get everything you want, and tomorrow I'm going to kill all of the Vinsmokes as well.
So, of course, the main point of this is the fact that, you know, Sanji is left. He's just heard all of this. You don't even, like, see his eyes. They're, like, completely... One of them is completely overwhelmed in shadow. Because, you know, the last light that he thought that he had has just been snuffed out. It was a lie all along. And he's left there in the rain with his gifts that he's still holding in his arms for her. And, of course, the main point is how this affects him.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also the angle of, okay, so what's going to go on with the Vinsmokes? I hope this doesn't result in, oh yeah, Sanji rebonds with his family and saves them and proves themselves. Like, I don't think that's going to happen.
That's actually really an interesting element of this, because he sees this situation develop in front of him with his sister being held hostage. Like, clearly Reiju doesn't want to be there. The last time we saw her, she was like walking down, like falling down a hallway bleeding in her legs, and we could see it still happening.
She's
now.
Still bleeding from the leg as she's being held there.
And it looks like the goo guy whose name I've forgotten, Don Slime or whatever, is like holding her wrist together too. So she's not sitting here having a conversation. She's being kept here. We know Sanji has some sort of affection for his sister. It's the only one he recognizes did care about him at all. And it's a really interesting scenario where he's like, my entire family's going to be killed, but I hate most of my family. What does Sanji do in that situation? Like, you know, does he just try to help Reiju, or is he able to say, like, go above and beyond and be like, I'm going to try to save my family, who they're shitheads, but they're my family. Like, it's just a really interesting thing to be like, what does Sanji do here? Like, this is a unique scenario to be put in. And it also really does put Sanji in a shitty place of two of, man, the thing that he held on to before, because he told Luffy and Nami to fuck off because this is what he had to do. He's like, well, at least I get to marry this sweet, beautiful woman. You know, I don't deserve someone who makes me this happy. And then he's like, oh, fuck, she's a bitch. She's just trying to kill me. So it's like,
well, I can't stay in this situation because, I mean, there's no point to it. You know, my family and myself will be killed.
Yeah, but he still can't get out of it either because the situation's still there. His hands will still explode. They'll still kill. Like, he's in an awful place now. He has almost nothing to hope. Like, what is Sanji doing at this point?
The only thing that can be said of this is that Sanji could, at least, is not in the attitude of just accepting this, you know?
Oh, yeah. I don't think that's Sanji's nature at all either. But it's one of the situations where you're like, I wonder what he does. It's really, he's back against the wall. He has absolutely no allies right now except maybe Reiju, and she's not in a position to really aid him very much. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, what happens from here? Like, we still don't even know what's going on with all the Straw Hats and everything. Chopper and Carrot are writing about. Brook we haven't seen for a while, but we know that there were people coming after him. Big Mom was coming after him. We haven't seen Jinbei in a very long time, so what's going on there? But all this is happening, we're just like, all right, we're building to that crescendo. I know that the note was that the Wano arc would begin sometime next year, so, you know, this arc is coming.
This definitely seems like they're going to have to escape. Yeah. And that's probably going to be the end of this arc, is them having to get away.
Yeah.
Possibly with maybe Pedro sacrificing himself. It seems to be where this is headed with, you know, his short lifespan, and what he had told Tamago about what his intents were. Sanji and the rest are going to have to run away, and maybe end up just leaving the Vinsmoke technology in Big Mom's grasp, for that matter.
It does. It seems like with all the build that Big Mom's group has gotten, like how almost every member of her family seems to be a significant character, and you know how there's the three generals and we still haven't even really met one of them yet. It would seem like a lot to kind of rush through and defeat all those characters, have Luffy conquer Big Mom, put an end to one of the four generals. So as you said, if they leave, that's a huge like unfinished part to build upon later on, you know. We already have enough about Blackbeard to know what that kind of conflict's going to be, and we've been getting a lot of details about Kaido. This would be a chance to put Big Mom on that same scale, being like, "Holy shit, this is a major antagonist to fight down the line."
Yeah. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what we get out of all of this. This arc has gotten a lot more interesting as a result of this. And, Straw Hats are ending the year in a pretty tight bind, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens to them. So that is going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap. Let's name our favorites from this week. I went with One Piece, and I went with Pudding.
Okay. Now, perfectly understandable. My MVP, or my chapter of the week is My Hero Academia. I love this chapter of One Piece. I think it's fantastic, but this chapter of My Hero Academia, I feel like, is going to be a chapter that goes down in, like, the history of that series is one of the biggest and most vital chapters of it. So, really love that one, and I'm going to go to that. My character of the week, I feel like I should give it to Pudding. But there's a part of me that can't help but give it to Baron Tobago, because I fucking love Legs Benedict. I can't stress enough how when he shouted out Legs Benedict, I cracked up fucking in like the room I was reading it in.
Legs Benedict.
That yes. Shit is amazing. Legs Benedict. Oh my god, that shit's a fantastic.
And One Piece won the popularity poll in the chat room, although My Hero Academy and Promised Neverland both got a lot of votes. All three of those really took up the lion's share. So, yeah, it's that. So, we're going to wrap things up here. Guys, thank you so much for listening in to Weekly Manga Recap. We tend to record the show on hitbox.tv/RollerT and also on twitch.tv/RollerT. You can follow us on Twitter to stay updated on when we record the show, which is usually Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. But in case we need to change things up, stay updated by following us at RollerT, at Y Roller of Time, and the podcast itself at WMR Podcast. You can also check out our past episodes on Weekly Manga Recap. Podbean.com and subscribe to us on iTunes and YouTube. If you want to give a little bit of help to the show, you can leave a like, leave a comment, leave a rating, and that really helps us out, especially in beating the woodworkers.
It is monumentally important towards helping us beat the woodworkers, guys, and I want to give a special thank you to the Dr. 14 who said, "Happy birthday, Chris, a great co-host to a great podcast with a wit that is simultaneously crude, wacky, and witty in one neat package." Oh, and Nick is there too. But no, thank you very much. Thank you for the birthday wish, but thank you very much for the 5-star review, because this does, I can't stress enough, guys, it is one of the most important things in helping this podcast grow is just giving it 5-star reviews.
Yeah. And helps to get some eyes on the podcast, and that's what's most important to us, honestly. Yes.
Helps us find new listeners and continue building upon everything.
And if you do want to help us out a little bit more, you can become a Patreon supporter. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. That's patreon.com/weeklymangarecap. Of course, you're also welcome to ask us questions, send in your feedback, and make suggestions for future manga for us to read, and send all that stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. And we are, as part of the end of the year, we are trying to figure out what our... they're going to for the year, and you can send that stuff to WMR Podcast as well. Don't forget to do that if you have some stuff. Like, if you want to suggest, I mean, we're already putting, of course, the speech on there that All Might gave this week, but if yes. You have a different speech in mind,
I'm actually, I can give you guys a list of some stuff, because I tried to say I was going to do it on Twitter, but unfortunately the past couple of weeks have been pretty brutal. But before I get to it, I just want to mention a couple people who recently became patrons that I want to throw out to. Ruburgerly, Gabriel Aurora, Mindy Walters, Matthias Holmquist, and Reed Strong. Thank you very much to all of you. There's one thing I want to note, guys. We made an announcement before that the bonus pop this month was going to be a radio play of the alternate telling of Bleach's ending, and we're still working on that. However, because of the fact that, you know, both Nick and I have not been as available, life has gotten in the way of both of us recently, we're not done with that yet. We actually haven't even started recording. We're still writing it. And the reason that we're still writing is because we didn't want to rush to get it done before the end of the holiday and not live up to kind of the idea we had for this thing. So
we want it to be as good as an end of the year podcast deserves, essentially.
Yeah. Like we want to make this as awesome as it's going to be. And I can tell you thus from what we even have thus far, it's going to be great. But there's going to be something else for everybody who's a champion patron this month. There's going to be another bonus podcast that we'll release instead of that one, basically. Basically, a thing to give you something before this one comes out. And the rules will still apply to anything else, like if a bonus pod's ever not out that month. If you're a patron the month of December, and, you know, say this podcast comes out next month then, and you're like, oh, I couldn't be a patron in the month of January, just let us know, and we'll get that to you. But just so everybody's aware, the radio play is still coming, but... it'll probably be start of 2017 when we actually get it out there, because there's still a lot of work to do on it, and we want to make sure that this thing is up to the quality that we have in mind for it. But as to the awards, that's what next week's going to be, and I have some of the categories here.
Our annual manga recap, we're going to talk about what our favorite parts of the year were. We're going to go back briefly over the suggestions that we fulfilled, and a new thing that we're doing this year is our awards, which we actually announced at the end of last year that we were going to be doing these.
Yes, I actually...
So we'll keep them in mind.
I started the list purposely after that to keep it in mind. So the categories we have, and some of these I've already filled out, but you're still feel free to send in thoughts on it. We have best villain, best hero, best speech, best power, best fight, best new character, best new design, best two-page spread, and best WMR created character. And if you have any other idea on a category you want in there, you know, the other one is biggest what the fuck moment of 2016 as well. So feel free to send in any thoughts you have on that. I'm probably going to compile everything and try to, you know, we'll have it all for next week, but, you know, send in any suggestions you have for them to the WMR Twitter at WMR Podcast.
And lastly, of course, we want to help extend our thanks to the guys who help us make the podcast possible. Infamous Planet and Steve Mann. Steve Mann created that very cleavagey title card that you see up there. And Infamous Planet created the frame around the whole visual podcast. So thanks, guys, so much. You can, if you want to check out all the different title cards that Steve Mann has made, he makes them available on his Patreon, patreon.com/Steve Mann. And I think he puts them up there for free.
Yes, if you want to check out any of the new title cards, Steve Mann has them on there. And you don't have to worry about it and be not safe for work either, too, because those ones are actually blocked from just, like, the thumbnail. So you can just go through and scroll for the WMR pod title cards if you're looking for them.
And finally, I've got a suggestion for the next manga that we're going to read. This one... Pardon me. This one comes from Michael Ryder. It's a series called Ballroom e Yokoso, also known as Welcome to the Ballroom, which is, and something in the line of Straighten Up, basically.
Okay. Very interesting. I'm looking forward to that. Nick, this is the last episode of 2016.
Yes, it is.
When we come back again and we're in 2017, you know, it's going to be a whole new world, a whole new everything. So any last thoughts you want to leave off on 2016 with? What's the sentiment we want to go into the new year with?
It's been an interesting year. I hope that next year is productive, that it's fun, that, it's even better than this year.
I hope that next year, in the vein of Toriko, guns just start appearing in space. Randomly, without reason, just guns are in space. And it's, maybe that's what NASA
does. If that one doesn't get nominated for best what the fuck moment, then what are we even doing?
Yeah, what's the point, guys? So that's it, guys. Thank you all for watching, and we'll see you next year.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye.